the life and ministry of David Brainerd. David Brainerd was born 1718 in Haddam, Connecticut. His parents were farmers and belonged to the Congregational Church. They were Puritans, taught their children the Westminster Catechism, and kept the Lord's Day with care. This strict upbringing gave David a sober outlook on life, one that approaching events would heighten. At the age of 8, he lost his father. By 15, he was an orphan. But as heartbreaking as these losses were, another evil was descending upon the young man, one that would not lift for more than 5 years. The thing that began besetting young David Brainerd was a sense of his sin and misery. He said, "I was much dejected, kept much alone, and sometimes envied the birds and beasts their happiness, because they were not exposed to eternal misery as I was." On one of his late night strolls, he recorded, "I remember in particular when I was walking solitarily abroad, I had open to me such a view of sin that I feared the ground would cleave asunder under my feet and become my grave, and I would send my soul alive into hell before I could get home. Though I was forced to go to bed, lest my distress should be discovered by others, which I much feared, yet I scarcely durst sleep at all, for I thought it would be a great wonder if I should be out of hell in the morning." David Brainerd, therefore, from a young age, possibly the age of 10 or younger, felt the need of salvation. He knew himself to be a sinner and knew that all sinners, including young ones, were exposed to the wrath of God. But although David Brainerd knew himself to be a sinner, he had absolutely no idea as to how a sinner was saved. And so, as most people do, young Brainerd started to try to save himself. But how would a man save himself? Well, Brainerd first tried good works. John Thornberry describes his youthful regimen. He abandoned those of his own age and associated himself with grave, elderly people. He spent much time every day in prayer and other secret duties. He read the Bible through twice in less than a year. He gave great attention to the public preaching of the gospel and tried to retain all he could from the pastor's sermons. On Sabbath evenings, he met with other young people to engage in religious exercises. And as soon as the meetings were over, he would repeat the discourses of the day to himself. At the end of the Lord's Day, he strove to meditate on all he had learned during the day, and Monday evenings found him recollecting the same themes. But the more he did, the more frustrated he became. He thought God was being hard on him by not respecting his considerable zeal. This ugly spirit only increased his sense of alienation. He found in the words of Toplady, "Not the labors of my hands can fulfill thy law's demands." And so David Brainerd first tried to save himself by good works. But if good works wouldn't avail, maybe something else would. Good feelings. Maybe it's not what he did that would make him right with God, but maybe if he felt the right things, God would accept him. He reasoned something like this: God promises to give grace to the humble. If, therefore, he could sufficiently humble himself, God would be obliged to save him. That's the workings of the young, unregenerate mind. And so he tried and he tried and he tried some more. But every time he seemed to be truly humble, it occurred to him that this feeling of being humble was obviously produced by pride. His sense of humility was further wounded by reading the Bible, especially Romans chapter 9 and verse 21, which galled him. "Does not the potter have power over the clay to make of the same lump one vessel for honor and another vessel for dishonor?" Here's what Brainerd said about it: "I could not bear that it should be wholly at God's pleasure to save or to damn me just as He would. It was a constant vexation to me. Reading or meditating on this always destroyed my good frames, good feelings. For when I thought I was almost humbled and almost resigned, this passage would make my enmity to the sovereignty of God appear. Young David, therefore, had another lesson to learn. This time, in the words of Edward Mote, "I dare not trust the sweetest frame." And so good works did not accomplish Brainerd's salvation, and neither did the effort to get good feelings. Everything he did for God was to no avail. Everything he felt for God was equally worthless. It seemed, therefore, that David Brainerd had tried very hard to save himself and been utterly frustrated. But if good works and warm feelings don't save, what does? Brainerd learned at about the age of 20, the only thing that saves sinners is God's grace. On another late night walk, he was struck by a couple of faults. First, salvation lay completely beyond his own power. And second, all of his past prayers, fasting, and exercises were worthless because they were based solely on self-interest and had no respect to the glory of God. This greatly relieved the struggling sinner. He began for the first time to look for salvation outside of himself. All the years before had been spent looking for something within, enough good works, the right state of heart. He was seeking salvation from something within himself. Finally, though, after 5 years of struggling for this internal assurance, he began looking for salvation in the right place, outside of himself, in Jesus Christ. On July 12, 1739, he tells us what happened. "As I was walking in a thick, dark grove, unspeakable glory seemed to open to the view and apprehension of my soul. I stood still, wondered and admired. My soul rejoiced with joy unspeakable to see such a God, such a glorious divine being, and I was inwardly pleased that He should be God over all forever and ever. I had no thought at first of my own salvation, and scarce reflected that there was such a creature as myself." When Brainerd stopped looking at himself, he found God. The prophetic word rings true: "Look unto me and be saved." David Brainerd had become a new creature. Old things passed away. All things became new. From this day on, he was brought, in his own words, to, quote, "a hearty disposition to exalt the Lord and to aim at His honor and glory as King of the universe." And so the conversion of David Brainerd did more than relieve the struggling soul. It did more than make him feel good. From that day on, it inspired a zeal within him to honor and exalt God as King of the world. At the age of 21, which was very late in those days, Brainerd entered Yale College for the purpose of preparing himself for the gospel ministry. The next 3 years would be a time of bitterness and sweetness. On the positive side, he excelled at his studies and stood at the head of his class. But despite his heavy workload, he did not neglect the one thing needful. His early manhood was marked by an abounding sense of sin, coupled with even a greater sense of grace. One of his entries will illustrate his early life. "In my morning exercises, my soul was exceedingly melted and bitterly mourned over my exceeding sinfulness of sin." So it seems here that he's cast down, maybe even despairing. But later that night he wrote, "My soul was carried forth in love to God and had a lively sense of God's love for me." These years saw, therefore, David Brainerd grow greatly in love for God. But it also saw, his affection for his fellow man grew. Jonathan Edwards wrote of his young friend, quote, "He dearly loved all mankind and longed that they would enjoy what he enjoyed." The days at Yale, therefore, were happy. So happy, in fact, that Brainerd called them, quote, "a little resemblance of heaven." But the college years were not unmixed with sorrow. He became sick and started the vomiting of blood that would eventually kill him. But worse than this was the deplorable standards then maintained at the college. Yale had been founded by the Puritans, for the production of godly and learned ministers. But within a single generation, the school had deteriorated and become really a place of learning for the purpose of pride and money making. The students were worldly minded, proud, and in love with money. Thus, Brainerd had few, if any, friends among his classmates. But worst of all was the haughtiness of his teachers. At chapel one morning, a tutor by the name of Mr. Whittlesey prayed with unusual fervor. Whittlesey's prayers were usually rather dull and dry. But one morning during the Great Awakening, which was a time of great religious excitement, even old Mr. Whittlesey prayed with unusual unction. Afterwards, in private, one of Brainerd's associates asked him what he thought of Mr. Whittlesey. Well, Brainerd was a young man and still an imperfected saint, and he made a very stupid remark, one that he would pay for dearly. Brainerd said about Whittlesey, "That man doesn't have any more grace than this chair." Very bad thing to say. It's probably true, but it's also a proud and insubordinate remark. Well, Brainerd's opinion finally reached Mr. Whittlesey, and Whittlesey hit the ceiling. He brought word to Thomas Clapp, who was then the rector of the college, and David Brainerd was promptly expelled. Brainerd did everything within his power to make things right. He apologized in words and also in writing. He sought to humble himself, and he greatly regretted the foolish statement that he made. But it seemed that the tutors and the men at the school were so haughty and so conceited in comparison to their students that no apology was sincere enough, no confession was good enough. David Brainerd was out. And though he was the top student in his class, Brainerd would never gain his hard-earned diploma. Never would the sheepskin be given to this young man. Although right now, if you look at the records of Yale University, you'll see his name on the roll of graduates. They finally repented many decades after Brainerd's death. Brainerd would later deeply regret and publicly confess his youthful pride. And although what he said was wrong, surely the punishment did not fit the crime. After leaving Yale, though, Brainerd took up residence with the Reverend Jedediah Mills, an aged and godly man. Under his tutelage, David excelled all the more in his studies and devotion to Christ. It was here, at the home of the old pastor, that his calling started to come into focus. Before this time, all Brainerd basically knew was he wanted to serve God and he wanted to preach the gospel. But in what capacity, in what form, he really had no idea. But in the years of living with Mills, it began coming into focus. It began internally. He began to yearn for the conversion of the Indian tribes scattered along the eastern seaboard. On April 8, 1742, 24 years old, he wrote, "Had raised hopes today respecting the heathen. Oh, that God would bring in great numbers of them to Jesus Christ. I cannot but hope that I shall see that glorious day." He began, Thornberry tells us, to take great delight in praying for their conversion. In fact, he found the thought of personally undergoing the greatest sufferings for their spiritual welfare very pleasant. One afternoon he so agonized in prayer for the advancement of Christ's kingdom among the heathen that he was drenched in his own perspiration. 7 months later, his call was confirmed. Agents for the Society in Scotland for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge contacted the young man and appointed him missionary to the Indians. Brainerd was so committed to this ministry that he spent the next 4 months riding from town to town, bidding his friends farewell and giving away his every possession. He did not want to be entangled in the world. When David Brainerd began his missionary effort, he literally had nothing but the clothes on his back and the books in his pocket. From now on, he would give himself entirely to the work of the ministry. He opened his work deep in the forest, about 18 miles west of Albany, New York. He obtained a translator and began urging a tribe of Indians to find rest in Jesus Christ. His method is really worth noting. How did he try to reach these savages? And they really were savage. First, he would begin each day rising before sunup for secret prayer. If you read the diaries of David Brainerd, which are available, you'd be surprised at the almost monotonous and repetition. Nearly every diary entry begins, "Rose early this morning to pray for my Indians. Rose before sunup to beseech God for the Indians. Wrestled with God all night in prayer for the Indians." Almost every entry begins in the same way. And so the first work of the ministry he found, evidently, was not preaching, but praying. He poured out his soul every morning and every night for the welfare of his Indians. He would then spend as much time as possible studying the Indian tongue so as to better communicate with his hearers. He began, of course, with the translator. But he didn't like the idea because it was kind of impersonal. And he didn't know if the translator was translating his words correctly. And so he worked very hard to learn these highly unusual languages. He would then preach to the people, often gaining an attentive hearing. After preaching, he would retire for more prayer and sometimes agonize late into the night for what he called his Indians. He had that kind of paternal care for these savages. Constantly, you'll notice this also in his diary, "My Indians, my Indians." He thought of them in almost a way that a father thinks of his own children. They seemed to have a unique relationship to him. These weren't just the Indians, the savages, the Redskins. These were his Indians, people for whom he had the greatest love and concern. And remember, he kept up this pace of early morning prayers, hard grammatical study, sermons, a daily sermons, and late night prayer meetings. He kept up all of these things, even during the freezing winters of the Northeast, and all the while spitting up blood, dying of tuberculosis. This first mission among the, I forgive my pronunciation, these are difficult, Kaunamik Indians, lasted about 1 year. It produced no spectacular results, but one I think that is quite impressive. When Brainerd informed his Indians that he must teach other tribes for the gospel too, they besought him to stay. As far as we know, there were no converts among his early Indians. And yet these people were so impressed by his life and so moved by his sermons that they would say, "Now that we have heard so much about our soul's concerns, we cannot bear to be without a minister." From eastern New York, he would ride south to the forks of the Delaware, where other Indians would hear of God's grace. But on the way there, Brainerd was intercepted by a man carrying a note. He had just been elected pastor of the church at East Hampton on Long Island. This was one of the largest and wealthiest churches in New England. Its pastorate would bring Brainerd wealth, respect, and the prestige Yale had robbed him of. But the great missionary was unmoved by the invitation. He was called to minister to the Indians, not white men, however well healed. It was declined without so much as a second thought. When Brainerd arrived on the Delaware, he was aghast at the wickedness of its residents, English and Indian alike. The former were especially averse to keeping the Sabbath holy. They were also ignorant of things divine and unwilling to discuss them. Astonishing thought. Brainerd had received a better hearing from the savage Indians than from his civilized countrymen. But if the white men were bad on the Delaware, the Redskins were even worse. These tribes were unusually devoted to their pagan feasts. They would lewdly dance around their totem poles. But worst of all, the Indians to a man were enchanted by their medicine men, people they call powwows. These were men in consort with evil spirits. These folks threatened to hex or poison or kill or murder any Indian who would give the young man a hearing. And so it was great opposition he faced on the forks of the Delaware. But amid all the trials, Brainerd's faith waxed stronger and stronger. Being all by himself among a superstitious and violent people caused him to lean more heavily upon God. It was certain that no gimmick, be it ever so clever, would reach these savages. And so Brainerd turned to the weapons of our warfare, praying, preaching, and holiness of life. And so Brainerd struggled for about a year on the banks of the Delaware and had no converts to show for his massive efforts. Yet oddly enough, this did not discourage him in the least. It seemed instead to strengthen his resolve to do the Indians good. Here's what he says in his diary. Last year, I longed to be prepared for a world of glory and speedily depart out of this world. But of late, all my concern almost is for the conversion of the heathen, and for that end, I long to live. From the time of this young man's conversion, now about 5 years ago, he'd longed for nothing more than to die and be with Christ. But now, for the first time in this melancholy and sick man's life, he wanted to live. Not to live to feather his own bed or to see his children grow up. He wanted to live so that he might do more good to the Indians. From the forks of the Delaware, he moved south to Cross Weeksung. And there, in 1745, he would learn that he that goes forth weeping, bearing precious seed, shall doubtless come again with rejoicing, bringing his sheaves with him. There he met, oddly enough, with instant success. The first day, his preaching attracted only 7 hearers, but by the third day, that number had risen to about 30. But the people, it seemed, were more than curious about the white man. They seemed anxious about their souls. One woman walked 15 miles a day to hear Brainerd's sermons. Several of his hearers were brought under deep conviction. He said, quote, they wept and wished that Christ would save them. One woman wept that, quote, she wished that God would change her heart. Another that, quote, she wanted to find Christ. And even an old chief wept bitterly because of his lost condition. So the wind bloweth where it listeth. In the earlier places, little or no results other than gaining the respect of people. But here at this third or fourth, this third mission that he took up, instant success. These Indians were no better by nature than their brethren of the north. They were sinners too, totally depraved and alienated from the life of God which is in Christ. And yet the Spirit of God moved mightily on them, and from literally the first day of work, Brainerd started seeing results from all his labors. They were so anxious to hear the word that they begged the young preacher to preach twice a day, in fact. One sermon a day wasn't enough to please these people. Within weeks, Brainerd's voice was drowned out by his hearers' bitter crying and shrieks of anguish. Some even collapsed under the conviction of sin and pleaded with God for mercy. On August 8th, Brainerd wrote, there was much visible concern among them while I was discoursing publicly. But afterwards, when I spoke to one and another more particularly, whom I perceived under much concern, the power of God seemed to descend upon the assembly like a mighty rushing wind, and with astonishing energy bore down all before it. I stood amazed at the influence that seized the audience almost universally, and could compare it to nothing more aptly than the irresistible force of a mighty torrent or swelling deluge, that with its insupportable weight and pressure bears down and sweeps before it whatever is in its way. Almost all persons of all ages were bowed down with concern together, and scarce one was able to withstand the shock of this surprising operation. Old men and women who had been drunken wretches for many years, and some little children, not more than 6 or 7 years of age, appeared in distress for their souls as well as persons of middle age. And it was apparent with these children that they were not merely frighted with seeing the general concern, but were made sensible of their danger and badness of their hearts, and their misery without Christ, as some of them expressed it. The most stubborn hearts were now obliged to bow. This religious movement was a powerful work of God's Spirit. And this we know not because it was attended by bodily convulsions and cries for mercy, but because of its solid and substantial fruit. Vicious sins were immediately renounced. Remember, these savages were living in civilization untouched by Christianity. Polygamy, wife beating, wife killing, child abuse, lying, cheating, stealing, rape, sodomy, all of these things regularly took place and without shame. But as soon as the word was preached, these vicious practices were given up. Even totem poles, which they considered the most sacred object of their worship, were cut down and burned. Drunkenness, which was a special temptation among Indians, was abandoned. Lazy men began to work. Even deadbeats started paying their bills. Not only did the Indians exhibit a hatred for sin, but a love for holiness as well. The Lord's Day was carefully observed, and every home set up family worship. But more amazingly, the Indians, whose ancestors had fought, murdered, scalped, and eaten one another, began loving the brotherhood. Brainerd, who was, remember, brought up in a Puritan home, one of the most Christian societies ever, marveled at his Indians. "Never did I see such an appearance of Christian love among any people in all of my life." Here was a boy raised in the heart of Puritan New England, brought up in a strict Congregationalist church, taught from his infancy the need to love one another. And yet it was nowhere in New England had he ever seen the kind of Christian love which gripped these Indians almost immediately after their conversions. And as you might expect, this work of grace excited within the Indians a desire for God's Word. Again, Brainerd wrote, quote, "My house being thronged with my people in the evening, I spent the time in religious exercises with them, till my nature was almost spent. They are so unwearied in religious exercises and insatiable in their thirsting after Christian knowledge that I can sometimes scarcely avoid laboring so as to greatly exhaust my strength and my spirits." David Brainerd, brought up in religious exercises, that means prayer, Bible reading, devotions, brought up in these things from infancy. I'm a young man who could pray all night and rise 5 o'clock in the morning to beseech God. These Indians were so excited about prayer and so insatiable in their thirst for Christian knowledge that they even wore this man out. Impressive. But best of all, the results Brainerd saw were permanent. After David's death, his brother John Brainerd, took over the mission and saw the same Indians grow old and even die in the Lord. He oversaw the work for more than 30 years. So these were not temporary converts, people who got briefly excited about Christianity. These were men and women and children who were obviously converted by God and spent the rest of their lives living for His glory. Brainerd, though, was more than their spiritual father. He was all but their natural father as well. He not only taught them the Bible and catechism, but also passed along a considerable amount of social and scientific knowledge. Under his ministry, in short, the savages joined Christian civilization. But even this success could not retain the great missionary. He sought, like Paul, to go where Christ had not been preached before. And so he left the revival scene to reach more Indians, this time in the southwest corner of Pennsylvania. The ride there, which was more than 100 miles, was nothing short of brutal. He was met with a violent storm which threatened his very life. The problem was compounded because the horse he was riding ate poison weeds. And though it didn't kill the animal, it made him so sick that he couldn't carry the man. And so David Brainerd, now get this, here's a man as skinny as a rail, underfed, overworked, spitting up blood, consumptive. That's the idea. That's the man himself. That's his physical condition. He's leading a horse in a driving rainstorm, freezing cold, hard blowing wind. Here he is, leading his horse through, at that time, was nothing short of a wilderness. And so into the teeth of a fierce wind and rainstorm, the frail missionary pushed on till he found a shelter. The best thing he could find was a shelter bark, in which he found rest that night. At a later date, he would endure another snowstorm, this time seated in a tree. These are the kind of hardships that he endured. This man had to basically live off the land. These long trips, days before refrigeration, were very difficult to make. He had moldy bread, which he ate. Mold and all. He had to live off nuts and berries and acorns and the like. He had to live like an animal, basically outdoors, enduring rain and snow and boiling heat. He did all of these things in order to reach the Indians with the gospel. Well, finally, he reached Susquehanna, and there met a tribe of Indians unmatched for its paganism. All the Indians were bad, of course, but these people were unusually depraved. Wild, naked, and idolatrous dances, often excited by the whiskey white men sold them, made the other tribes seem civilized by comparison. But these people, too, were reached with the gospel. And although they were not as radically changed as the Indians on the Delaware, some success was achieved even among these princes of Satan. But all of the strain was too much for Brainerd's weak constitution. The travel, the storms, the cold, the heat, the poor diet, and the unceasing labor of love finally proved too much. He rode to Northampton, Massachusetts, to visit his old friend Jonathan Edwards. There he became bedridden, and there he would breathe his last breath. But not before he proved to this eminently learned and judicious man the greatness of his soul. Had Brainerd lived, Edwards would have given him his favorite daughter, Jerusha, in marriage. After his death, the great thinker who could not be fooled by superficial religion, the great thinker edited and published Brainerd's diaries, counting it the most valuable literary work he ever undertook. That's remarkable. Jonathan Edwards is considered the greatest thinker of colonial America. His work on the freedom of the will, which is really work on the bondage of the will, is considered a classic. No one has ever studied the doctrine of free will versus predestination who has not read carefully Edwards' treatise. Even the most ungodly and learned men consider it to be indispensable. And yet Edwards, though he wrote this massive work, and though he wrote countless other things, great sermons and other essays and tracts, and wrote a history of redemption and many other things, considered editing, publishing the diaries of David Brainerd to be the most important thing on which he ever put ink to paper. One of Brainerd's last sayings concerned the Bible. We don't know what his last words were exactly. He lay in Jonathan Edwards' bed for some weeks, often saying pious and marvelous things, but the one quotation I think is worth our attention is this. When a friend came to his room carrying the sacred volume, Brainerd, barely able to talk, announced in a strong voice, "Oh, that dear book, that lovely book! I shall soon see it opened. The mysteries that are in it and the mysteries of God's providence will soon be unfolded to me." And so David Brainerd died October 9th, 1747. How old do you think he was? 29 years. 29 years old. Now, a few concluding remarks on Brainerd's character, views, and work may be in order. David Brainerd is sometimes assailed as a severe melancholic, a man always in a fit of depression. One author even called his book on Brainerd flagellant on horseback, as though the only thing he did was torture himself because of his sins. But this is patently untrue. His early life was marked by doubt, guilt, and fear. But this was because he was still under the wrath of God. And it's downright impious to not be racked by guilt and fear and doubt if you're unconverted. But after his conversion, he often rejoiced in the Lord, and under circumstances his critics would be hard to match. It's easy to sit back in an easy chair and criticize a man for his melancholy, for his melancholia, while this man rejoiced in the Lord, sleeping all night in a tree, lying in the mud, riding all night on horseback. Much easier to criticize him than to duplicate him. Moreover, his sorrow over sin, rather than causing him to retreat into self-pity, introspection, or nothing, rather urged him to greater efforts to extend God's kingdom. Only a man painfully aware of the misery of sin will be moved with compassion over other sinners. When he saw these Indians naked, drunken, violent, vile, wicked, depraved in every way, he didn't stand as an Englishman looking down on these wretched savages. He stood as a sinner standing on the same ground as other sinners. And so David Brainerd was not a severely depressed man. He did tend to be sad and have a what the writer called autumn in his heart. However, he was not really a melancholic. He was not a melancholic. He was not a man given to fits of depression. He was comparatively well balanced, and considering the unusual difficulties of his circumstances, I think his rejoicing in the Lord was admirable. Then, second, David Brainerd's doctrine ought to be looked at. His great work was carried on by two main ideas: the sovereignty of God and the success of missions. It seemed that the Indians were beyond saving, or so it seemed, if God were in any way limited. But Brainerd did not believe God was limited. He believed that God was almighty. Therefore, even the grossest, most abandoned, and idol-ridden people could be saved. But Brainerd believed more than sinners could be saved. He believed they would be saved. Yea, according to the promises of God, sinners must be saved. He was a strong believer in the latter-day glory, during which time his kingdom spread from shore to shore, till moons shall wax and wane no more. Finally, a word about Brainerd's contribution to world missions. This man labored only about 4 years, but did more for missionary work than perhaps anyone since the Apostle Paul. His preaching won a number of Indians to the faith. His life inspired others to enter the mission field. But most importantly, his diaries published after his death galvanized the missionary movement worldwide. Robert Murray McShane was greatly inspired by Brainerd's short life. In his diary, the Scottish preacher wrote, quote, "Life of Brainerd, most wonderful man. What conflicts, what depressions, what desertions, advance, strength, victories in thy torn bosom. I cannot express what I think of thee." And then a little bit later in that same entry, he said, "Tonight, more set upon missionary enterprise than ever." So remarkable, isn't it? David Brainerd, who never left the shores of America, had a direct influence on the missionary movement in Scotland. Robert Morrison, missionary to China, counted the Apostle Paul, John Eliot, and David Brainerd as the men who inspired him to his heroic work. Henry Martin, missionary to India and Persia, traced his first interest in foreign work to the life of David Brainerd. But perhaps most significantly, William Carey, who is often thought of as the father of modern missions, would meet with his associates, Mr. Marshman and Mr. Thomas, 3 times a year in Serampore, and recite these words. This is a quotation. "Let us often look at Brainerd in the woods of America, pouring out his very soul before God for the people. Prayer, secret, fervent, expectant, lies at the root of all personal godliness. A competent knowledge of the languages where the missionary lives, a mild and winning temper, and a heart given up to God. These are the attainments, more than all other gifts, which will fit us to become God's instruments in the great work of redemption." And so Carey and his associates met 3 times a year for the purpose of thinking about Brainerd and finding inspiration from his short but heroic life. How great must Brainerd have been if men as eminent as McShane, Martin, and even Carey looked up to him as their great example? But David Brainerd is not only an example to these men, also long dead, but he ought to be an example to us as well. The life of David Brainerd ought to teach us the following. First, the great amount that can be done in a short time if one is fully committed to God. Brainerd's work lasted only 4 years, his life only 29. Yet how much he did. Teach us to number our days that we might attend our hearts unto wisdom. You know, when you reach middle age, you begin feeling how little you've done. Maybe as a young man or young woman, you thought you would really do something for God. But now as the years have passed and you've married and you've had children, you look back over the last 5 or 10 or 20 years and you think of how little you've done for your Savior. This has a paralyzing effect on us. It seems to make us throw up our hands in despair. Look at this, I've wasted 20 more years. I've wasted 20 years. No use trying anything nowadays. Look how much Brainerd did in only 4 years. Look how much he did in only 4 years. And thus, if we would commit ourselves more fully to God, and if we would sanctify the Lord God in our hearts and make His glory and the honor of His name of paramount importance, how much we could do, even those of us who've lived 30 or 40, 50 or maybe even 75 years, how much we could do in the time that God has allotted to us. So never become discouraged about how many years you've wasted. Use those wasted years to excite you to greater efforts in the present and future. Then note, secondly, the enormous value of prayer and holiness of life. These were Brainerd's chief weapons. He preached to ignorant peoples in foreign languages. His sermons, therefore, couldn't have been brilliant. It's just absolutely inconceivable to me that Brainerd's sermons were brilliant and learned and eloquent. He was stumbling along in these languages. No man can master a language in 4 years, no less several. All of these tribes spoke different languages, mind you, some of which had nothing in common with others. And surely none of his translators were expert in English. And so David Brainerd was kind of talking in an elementary, kind of simplified way. His sermons had to be just about as basic as they could be. And yet look at the power they had. What gave them their immense influence? It couldn't have been their brilliance or their learning or their eloquence. It had to be something else. Prayer and holiness of life. A man who wrestles with God all night long finds power with men as well. That was the secret to David Brainerd's success and shall be ours as well. If I could go to a quick tangent, William Chalmers Burns was Brainerd's contemporary and sort of counterpart in China. He too had great success in converting Chinese to the faith. But you know where his secret lay? Well, one Chinese man put it this way. Look, there's Burns. He's the holiest man in China. That's what we need to worry about. Matthew Henry said it's not one of numbers, but one of holiness that hinders the advancement of Christ's kingdom. More prayer, greater holiness would make your efforts to win your lost friends and family members so much more effective. Can't argue with a godly example. Then thirdly, we should mark the importance of love for sinners. David Brainerd, Jonathan Edwards said, and Edwards was not given to exaggeration, quite the opposite. Brainerd, it was said, had a love for all mankind and wanted above everything else that others would enjoy the grace that had been given to him. Freely he'd received, very freely, just as freely he would give. The importance of love for sinners. You see, these Indians were probably as cynical as your friends. They probably figured that, well, you know, Brainerd was doing his duty because maybe the Christian God would roast him in hell if he didn't. Or that maybe Brainerd was just trying to get them to go along and follow the steps of the white man. Or maybe he was being paid a large salary to go out and talk to the Indians. That's what they may have thought at first. But in getting to know the young minister, they were gripped with the feeling that this man truly loves us. He's not just doing his duty. He's not merely meeting the expectations of those who sent him. He's not doing this, in other words, for a paycheck. There is no ulterior motive. All he wants is our best. For surely a man who stays up all night while vomiting blood in prayer for us must have a great love for us. The importance of love for sinners. Again, sinners can argue against doctrines, they can mock against theological conceptions, but they can make no argument against love for them. And then lastly, the importance of good literature, especially in the lives of children, comes out in the life of David Brainerd. What books most influenced him, I can't say. But I can say this, his diaries had a huge and worldwide effect on other people. Young men, children, were greatly influenced in reading his life. How many men went into the missionary field because they read Brainerd's diaries? can't be known, but surely many did. And how many ordinary Christians were excited to greater evangelistic zeal in reading his works? Absolutely no way of knowing, but we know this much. The numbers must have been immense, because this diary, published in the 1740s or 50s, remains in print, and I think has been continuously in print, even to this late date, more than 200 years later. And so it's obvious that this literature, his diaries, has had a great influence on people down through the ages. This is a man you can hold up for your children and say, be like him. Not be like the guy who hits 40 home runs and has 40 girls on the side. Not be like the man who throws 60-yard passes and then bends his elbow the rest of the night. Oh, how sad and depraved the examples we have today for children. How sad. It seems that the leading characteristic that all children admire is money. He's a great guy because he's rich. She's great because she just piles up the money. Rock and roll stars, sports figures, in general, ungodly people. These are the people the world looks up to, and frankly, our children are often conformed to the world in this matter. We ought to share with them the knowledge of godly people like Brainerd. People who from their earliest years, or at least their young, early years, were devoted to God. And so the life of David Brainerd shows us the great value of Christian literature in the home. Children watch too much TV. It's as simple as that. In the examples they're exposed to on TV range from bad to worse. We need to expose our children to good books, to work their minds, more importantly, to reach their hearts, to excite within them a desire to follow that which is good and not that which is evil. I urge you parents, therefore, to be readers yourself. The best way to get your children to read is when they see you read. The worst way to do it is to beat them into reading. Reading is something I'd have to do to avoid a spanking or a scolding. Wrong. We ought to encourage our children to be readers by reading ourselves. We ought to make available to them. We ought to spare no expense. We ought to forego other pleasures to procure good reading material for our children so that they might read the lives of people like Brainerd. And who knows, maybe be aroused to a similar life. I pray God will bless this lecture to that end, for Christ's sake. Amen.